This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyesh Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
he said they would continue fighting terrorism until separatists in the two English-speaking regions drop their guns or are defeated.
That's reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka on Cameroon President Paul Biya's inauguration speech. Details next.
Also, U.S. voters today vote on a new Congress, and Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar is on the edge of making history to become the first woman from Africa to join the U.S. House of Representatives.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon President Paul Biya, the second longest serving African leader at 36 years in power, has been inaugurated for another 7-year mandate. In his speech, Biya promised to defeat terrorism in the country, but made no mention of 82 people kidnapped on Monday in Cameroon's Anglophone region. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroonians sang the national anthem Tuesday as President Paul Biya was sworn in for another 7 years in power. In his speech, Biya promised to solve Cameroon's problems and urged unity. He said they would continue fighting terrorism until separatists in the two English-speaking regions drop their guns or are defeated.
Dans nos régions du nord-ouest et du sud-ouest, des forces négatives.
He says in the northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon, negative forces took advantage of some worker complaints to execute their separatist plans and acts of terrorism. Violence broke out, so the government responded with measures to preserve public order, he says, and assure the safety and security of people and their property. Secession is against Cameroon's constitution, says Biya, and the indivisible nature of the nation. Biya made no mention of gunmen kidnapping 79 students and 3 teachers on Monday from a school in the northwest region. Cameroon authorities say the gunmen are separatists, while a separatist spokesman claims the military is framing them for the abduction. On the walkway of Yaoundé City Council, hundreds of people displaced by the region's fighting watched the inauguration on a giant screen TV. 55-year-old Julius Tetang says he has been hosting 30 displaced people from the English-speaking town of Bengui. He wants Biya to find a solution to the region's unrest.
They have about 18 secondary schools and none is going. They have about 76 primary schools and all are empty. Most of the inhabitants have abandoned their areas. The rate of killing is heavy. People are running away from bullets.
32-year-old Cletus Fonyi fled fighting in the English-speaking town of Kumbo. He says his wife and brother were killed last month in clashes.
Mr. Biya has been given another chance to stop killing our people of the northwest and southwest regions. He should ask his military to stop killing our people. These are really, they are brothers. We said we are one, so he should do something to really show that we are one.
Biya was declared the winner of the October 7 presidential poll with a landslide victory of 71% of the vote. His strongest challenger, Maurice Kamto, was a distant second with 14%. Kamto and his supporters claim the poll was rigged by election bodies chosen by Biya and loyal to him. Security forces on Tuesday's unstopped Kamto's supporters from trying to protest Biya's inauguration. 24-year-old Christopher Bimi says police prevented him from protesting what he called Biya's stolen victory.
So he has been there for 36 years. Youths are suffering too much. Youths that have really gone to school and they are having certificates in their pocket, but they suffer all over the country.
Biya has been in power in Cameroon for over four decades, serving 7 years as prime minister and 36 as president. In 2008, he removed term limits from the constitution, allowing him to serve indefinitely. When his new term is finished, he will be 93 years old. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Thank you, Moki. Well, hours before Biya was sworn in, a spokesman for the self-proclaimed Amazonia separatist movement told VOA's James Butte their forces had rescued the abducted students and teachers. Chris Anu, Secretary of State for Communication of the group, says the students could be turned over to their parents as early as today. However, as of now, there is no sign they have been freed. Anu, who spoke from the U.S. city of Houston, Texas, rejected allegations the separatists abducted the children. He blamed government forces. Cameroon Information Minister Issa Chiroma Bakary told VOA late last night that he had no knowledge about an expected release of the students.
U.S. voters today choose a new Congress and thousands of state and local offices across the country. Public opinion polls and analysts suggest the opposition Democrats may win control of the House of Representatives. That could change the balance of power in Washington, as President Donald Trump's Republican Party currently controls both the House and the Senate. Immigration has been a major focus of the campaign, with Trump and other Republicans blasting Democrats for policies they say allow people to enter the country illegally. Democrats have struck back by saying that Trump is using fear and racism in his campaigning. Several television networks and Facebook stopped running one Republican television ad in particular, saying it inappropriately used race in depicting an illegal immigrant who was convicted of murdering police officers.
Also, Yeheas, Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar is on the edge of making history in American politics today, as she is favored to take a seat in the U.S. Congress and become the first former refugee and the first woman from Africa to join the House of Representatives. Omar says using politics to make a positive impact and expand democracy is important to her. Abdulaziz Osman reports from Minneapolis. Rob Raphael narrates.
36-year-old Ilhan Omar came to Minnesota 20 years ago after fleeing from war-torn Somalia and spending 4 years in a refugee camp in Kenya. Omar is expected to easily defeat her Republican challenger, Jennifer Zielinski, in Minnesota's solidly Democratic 5th Congressional District. If Omar wins Tuesday, she could be joined in the House by another Muslim woman, Democrat Rashida Tlaib from Detroit, who is poised to win a seat in her race for the House of Representatives. Omar says that if she goes to Washington, she will take on President Donald Trump, who she says is promoting policies that prevent people like her from coming to America.
These policies are very dangerous. I think they go really against the ideals of this nation, and I hope to go to Washington with colleagues who are like-minded for us to take back the House and possibly the Senate and hold him accountable to the policies that he's pushing that are about fear and division.
Ilhan Omar made history in 2016 when she joined the Minnesota House of Representatives and became the first Somali-American lawmaker in her state, which is home of the country's largest Somali-American community.
The chance of using politics as a tool to create positive change really has been one that has inspired me to get involved in politics, to stay engaged in the opportunity of expanding our democracy for everyone, and running to really create policies that will have positive impact on people's lives.
In a year with a record number of women running for public office, Omar inspired many Muslim women across the nation, including Hodan Hassan, who is running for the Minnesota House of Representatives.
The reason why many women are running are two things. One, hashtag MeToo movement, and then number two, Donald Trump. Donald Trump was elected and the basis of he continuously disrespected women. So I think those two combined have ignited a lot of women to change the status quo. And one of the ways you can change the status quo is run for an office.
The midterm election comes at a critical time as the United States faces a bitter partisan divide. Hassan says politicians should bring the country together and spread more unifying messages. For Abdulaziz Osman in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Robert Rafael, VOA News.
The Spanish Coast Guard today is searching for several missing migrants after at least 17 died over the past 24 hours trying to cross from North Africa to Spain. The Coast Guard said Monday it rescued about 80 people from two rafts between Spain, Morocco, and Algeria. They were taken to the Spanish enclave of Melilla in North Africa. In addition, 22 men were rescued in the Atlantic near the Spanish city of Cadiz. But there are fears at least 17 people are still missing. This year, Spain has become a major destination for migrants trying to cross from North Africa into Europe after Italy's government began refusing to allow migrants to land.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Cameroon's President Paul Biya has been inaugurated for another seven-year mandate. And U.S. voters today vote on a new Congress, and Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar is on the edge of making history to become the first woman from Africa to join the U.S. House of Representatives. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Many people from other African countries travel to South Africa every day in search of work and better lives. Many of them do not have proper documentation, and some end up dying in the country. The South African government and humanitarian organizations have been trying to identify some of the bodies left unclaimed in morgues to bring answers to families left wondering about lost loved ones. From Johannesburg, Yashira Ramprasad has the story.
South Africa has long attracted men and women who leave their home countries in search of better lives away from extreme poverty, violence, and war. While authorities do their best to ensure migrants are documented, many live in the country without any form of identification. This poses a problem when migrants die in the country. Their bodies are often left in morgues, unclaimed. Forensic scientists try their best to identify bodies so the victims' families can be told. However, this is not always possible. The International Committee of the Red Cross works closely with South African authorities to identify remains. Stephen Fonseca is the organization's regional forensic manager for Africa.
We know that migrants will often arrive at a mortuary with no documentation, perhaps documentation that doesn't accurately represent who they are to their families. For a number of reasons, they're not going to be identified. And so what can we do to support the existing structures, certainly in South Africa and the countries of origin, to complement what they're doing with other processes and techniques, other procedures, developing these methods of maximizing the potential for identification.
But Fonseca says as hard as they work, the numbers of unidentified in South Africa's morgues are just too high.
South Africa has the luxury of some tremendous expertise. They have everything here that is needed to build the kind of flagship that we would like to see replicated around Africa. South Africa has a volume issue, really. There wouldn't be a country in the world that could manage the volume that you see going through mortuaries.
One forensic pathology lab handles 3,000 cases a year. Last year, 319 bodies weren't identified. South African forensic scientist Janine Velima explains the process of trying to identify a body.
Where there is no visual identification or anybody arriving, we'll do the fingerprints and we'll take a blood sample for DNA. And we'll also do post-mortem radiography. We look for implants. Implants in a body have code numbers on them, and if you've got the code number of an implant or a serial number of an implant, you can often track down where it was, you know, where it's from and where it went. And we look for old trauma, anything that could possibly assist in identification. We look at what possessions might have been on the person. We document and photograph it very carefully. We look at their clothing, where it might have been bought. We do, where we can, forensic odontology. And obviously, in addition to all of that, we've done the fingerprints and the DNA. The thing about it, though, is all of this is kind of useless if it's not in some kind of a database anywhere. So you've always got to compare a fingerprint. Just taking a fingerprint and taking DNA doesn't help unless you've got something to compare it with.
Velima explains that some of the bodies they managed to identify have been traced back to neighboring countries. She says in the past financial year, her lab processed 108 unidentified cases.
Of those 108 cases, who would all have been buried as potentially as unidentified, we've identified 39 of them. Of the ones that we've identified, 41% of them, only 41% of them were South African. 8% were Zimbabwean, 3% Nigerian, 3% Lesotho, 3% from Malawi, 3% from Uganda, and 41% we still don't know.
Fonseca says that no matter how much effort goes into the identification process, it's worth it when families find the closure they're looking for.
The one mother that I met who was with her husband reporting their son as being, you know, unaccounted for in South Africa, I think, you know, she really hit home for us when she said, every single night I go to sleep wondering where he is. Every single night. There isn't one night in my life since he's been gone that I haven't thought about where he is.
Despite the work of morgue staff, many people, including migrants, are buried in South Africa, nameless and without their families and friends ever knowing. Fonseca and Velima say their work will continue, despite the odds. I'm Yashira Ramprasad for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Nigeria's trade unions have called off plans to begin a nationwide strike today after reaching a tentative agreement with the government on a minimum wage increase. The Nigerian Labour Congress says a negotiation committee with the government agreed on a new monthly minimum of 30,000 naira, or about $82,000, up from 18,000 naira. The unions initially had sought 50,000 naira a month. The government said the past few years of low oil prices has left the economy too weak to handle that large of an increase. The committee is recommending that President Muhammadu Buhari accept the latest proposal. In September, unions held a four-day national strike but suspended it when the government resumed negotiations.
Well, Madagascar votes tomorrow, with four former heads of state vying for the top job in a pool of 36 candidates. Analysts predict this contest will go to a second round, and the nation's persistent problems, poverty, health challenges, poor infrastructure, and human rights abuses will continue no matter who wins. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Voters in the island nation of Madagascar will see a crop of familiar names on this year's ballot, as four former presidents are trying to get back into power among a crowded field of 36 candidates. That should surprise no one, says analyst Lisa Lovaudrin of the Institute for Security Studies.
You have really a very poor country with a very small elite, and they tend to, you know, all want to dominate the politics, and there's no real organized political base either, no dominant political party.
Basically, poll watchers say this is a three-way race between the last three presidents: Mark Ravalomanana, the man who ousted him in a 2009 coup, Andry Rajoel, and the man who succeeded Rajoel, but resigned in September so he could legally run for re-election, Henri Rajonnery Mampian, who for obvious reasons is often simply referred to as Henri. Analyst Piers Pigou of the International Crisis Group says Madagascar's presidency is not a job many would aspire to. The former French colony has been politically shaky for nearly two decades, the worst moment coming in 2009 with the coup that deposed Ravalomanana. The nation is renowned for its biodiversity, its vanilla crops, and its stunning beaches, but also for its crushing poverty, recurrence of bubonic plague, and frequent, devastating cyclones.
The socioeconomic indicators show that in the last 5 years or so, 5 to 10 years, the situation has deteriorated rapidly. Long-time Madagascar watchers are saying they haven't seen it this bad in the last 30 to 40 years. And the depth of poverty appears to be growing exponentially every year. Now, the big challenge, of course, is how does any new government turn around the economic prospects with limited raw materials, limited resources, and limited opportunities.
And rights groups say the challenge is more than economic. Watchdog Amnesty International says it has documented a recent spike in human rights violations and excessively harsh law enforcement. Amnesty spokesman Robert Chivambu says the next president needs to deal with that.
This begins by effectively protecting human rights defenders, including their right to freedom of expression, and releasing pretrial detainees whose detention has been unjustified and have been enduring long jail terms for petty and nonviolent crimes.
But Pigou said he doubts this election is about policies. As is all too common in the small circle of Malagasy politics, he says this is a personality contest. That, he says, is evident in the campaigning around the single biggest issue in the country, the economy.
I mean, none of the candidates appear to have a serious economic plan that does anything more than perhaps tick some boxes from the international financial institutions in terms of improved management and improved accountability. We don't have a development plan on the table, and I think that's the biggest challenge.
If no candidate wins 50% plus one vote, the top two candidates will face off on December 19th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Americans vote in the U.S. midterm elections on November 6th. We'll examine what the results mean for America's domestic and foreign policy, particularly as they relate to Africa and Africans. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Africa.